I'm Pamela Lafayette-Gleese. Michelle asked me to come talk a little bit about the relevance of Jewish law in the context of family law. I am an American family law professor, but I have the great zchut this year to have been asked to teach Israeli family law, and I've also taught a lot of comparative family law over the last 6 years, so I've been familiar, but never as familiar as I currently am, because there's nothing like teaching something to help you learn what's it like. So I'm going to talk about three questions today. When precisely is Jewish law relevant in modern Israeli family law? And that's going to be, we have to divide that into two questions. Jurisdiction, like when do you go to the Beit Din and when do you go to the civil court? And then no matter which court you're in, when does Jewish law apply? And the second question on topic, we'll talk about the role of ketubot in modern Jewish divorce law. And finally, I want to talk a little bit about the role of fault, asham, when guilt is involved in divorce law. And I'll compare it a little bit to civil family law, the way it's used and how it compares to Jewish family law. Okay. So when does Jewish law apply in modern Israeli family law? So in the start of the country, there was the idea that when it comes to issues of personal status, ma'amad ishi, that would be governed by religious law. So for Jews, that's Jewish law. For Muslims, that's Islamic law. And for Christians, that's Christian law. And within the Christian and Muslim communities, there are lots of little mini sects. And so it's really, really complicated. And I have to say, as a teacher of family law, it's really humbling because I have students of all faiths in my classes. And of course, I don't have as much access to Muslim law because it's all written in Arabic. And this is not just my problem. This is a universal problem where we don't have access to the sources. We bring in, there's one family law professor, an Islamic family law professor, who's willing to come in to the Israeli classes. But it's really hard to find people who are willing to come in. And so then you have these lots of Arabs, both Christian and Muslim, but mostly Muslim, who don't get to learn their own family law in law school. So that was an interesting realization for me.
Stuff isn't translated, or once it's translated, it's already interpreted.
There's not only that, there's no precedent system in the family law system, so it's not really, particularly in their family law system. So when law comes out of the civil courts, it tends to have precedential effect, but when law comes out of the Batei Din or the religious courts of Islams and Christians, some of them may be published, but it's not supposed to be very precedential. It's every case by case, as opposed to a precedential system. So we do teach a little bit, and things are translated. We give a sense, but we're much more in control of what's going on in the Jewish system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because we read Hebrew, right? Just from that simple place. Okay, so what is the law of personal status? So when the state first started, it meant more than it does today. Personal status, ma'amad ishi, is marriage and divorce law. So you know that getting married in Israel is always done by religious law. Actually, there's one exception. If both the partners have no faith registered on their tu'udat, but you can't decide you're no faith. But if you've heard of people that have no religion, and so then it will come out in official papers or whatever. But other than that, if you have an official religion, and we all do, you have to get married within the religious system, and you also have to get divorced. And also, child support and spousal support is governed by religious law. Spousal support is not like civil spousal support. It's only until you get a get. It's not like alimony, like we may know from the U.S., where you can get that after you divorce. In Israel, spousal support is just until the woman gets a get, and it's only from man to woman. Used to be that physical and legal custody was also part of personal status. Not anymore. So now there's a civil law that they've said that when it comes to custody, that's now going to be governed by civil law. Although sometimes religious law sneaks in for the details. When things aren't clear according to the civil law, so courts might use religious law to, for the details. Inheritance used to be more a matter of religious law, now it's a matter of civil law because of a law that was passed. And property distribution at divorce, which is the big one, for years, the religious courts were applying property divorce, property distribution according to religious law, which does not recognize the right of one partner to property that is registered in the other partner's name. So if you get divorced and all the property is registered in the man's name and the woman is not registered in her name according to religious law, she might get her ketubah, but she doesn't get to take his property. That's actually considered theft, and it says that in the sources. And so this was a huge problem. There was a big Supreme Court case about this because the rabbis did not want to give her a property distribution, and according to the civil norms of, every place was giving women property. So this was a big rift, and finally it's happening, right? Now the rabbinical courts will apply property distribution and divorce, although it's not the same as what the civil courts will do. So they tend to be less willing to give, but they give. And they've done it by all sorts of things. Like, they're not going to... It's hard. You know, it's a big conflict because you're telling... So far I've said, when does religious law get involved? But the second part of the puzzle is, when does the Beit Din get to decide? So there's always two issues. What law applies and who's deciding? So because the Beit Din... So when does the Beit Din get to decide? Beit Din always decides... The religious courts always decide when it's a marriage and divorce. And anything that is karuch, anything that is attached to the divorce claim. So... Custody doesn't need to be attached. It can always be decided by the Beit Din. But property distribute what?
By the Beit Din or by the civil court?
By the Beit Din.
Oh, it can be decided?
Can be decided, but according to what law? Civil law. So this is very hard for the Beit Din. We've made the Beit Din, we've put the Beit Din in a very difficult position. Because we've told the Beit Din that they can decide, marriage and divorce is not a problem, because that's according to religious law. But we've told the Beit Din that they can decide property distribution if it's attached to the divorce. They can always decide custody. And they can decide, now we even say they can decide child support.
But they're supposed to decide it based on civil law.
But they need to decide it based on civil law. So this is very hard for the Beit Din.
They're not even used to using the presidential system, which you have to do to make this decision.
A presidential system, but also they're not into doing things that are against halacha.
Right.
So what do they do? So for property distribution, so child support and spousal support is according to Jewish law. So that's easy for them. Right? So even when the civil courts decide spousal support and child support, it's according to Jewish law. So that's easy for the Beit Din. But when the Beit Din has to decide property distribution, they need to do it according to civil law. Now, how are they going to do that?
No, so they. I'm confused. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
That's your question.
Where the sources of the Jewish law are the Gemara, obviously.
Right.
So let's say in the Gemara we learn that a father is only obligated to support his children until they're like 4 years old.
Right.
So where does the source for child support come from? It's obviously not.
So we do certain things to expand it. So like within the context of property distribution, how are you going to get a rabbi to give a woman property that's registered in a man's name? So they've come up with little fixes, haskama michlala, that there's been an agreement. They can read a contract. Contracts are very big in Jewish law, as you know, ketubot, da da da. So we understand from the nature of what they're doing that there's an agreement. So child support also... According to Jewish law, it only needs to be a certain amount of time, but they supplement because it's based on what a child needs. And nowadays, things have changed. Children need a little bit longer. They don't start working at the age of six. But what's true is that if you take the same case and you give it to even though the same law is supposed to apply, if you give it to a rabbinical court and you give it to a civil court, it's going to come out a little different and in different things and in different ways. When it comes to child support, the rabbinical courts tend to give less, and the civil courts against to give more. That being said, the rabbinical courts only give it to a man to a woman, and they don't care how much money the woman makes. So if you're a high-earning woman, you would be better off going to the rabbinical court, because you'll get child support, whereas the civil court would say, why would we give child support? You earn enough money, and you don't necessarily, and you have joint custody. And the rabbinical courts don't really think that way. They think it's an obligation from man to woman, just basic needs. So it's a low amount, but it's pretty much always given, no matter what the situation. So
and
it's
you get different
very complicated.
Which Beit Din you go to?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Always. Every year.
That we know.
I think so. it's not only a question of civil to Beit Din.
Okay, so we've done all
right,
this.
It's within Beit Din, right?
Okay.
So all in all, obviously, it sounds like it's much more complicated having two.
Right. So why is it so complicated? Right. Because there's there's a civil system and a religious system working side by side, sometimes deciding the same issues, usually deciding on the basis of the same law, but doing it in different ways. And there's also a lot of power struggles between the two systems, where the Beitin likes to say, we always have jurisdiction, we always get to decide. Civil system is a little bit more lazy, let's say. Like, they're willing to give the Beitin, but sometimes they just can't. Like, with the property distribution was a big thing. We're like, we can't actually keep going like this and not giving women
when
property.
When was this decision?
77. It's a court, bagatz called Bavli. And that was like, whoa, big earthquake, and everything was different after that. And to give a lot of credit to the Batei Din, who were asked to do the impossible. You know, some people say, well, given that that was the crisis, what we should have really done is taken jurisdiction of property distribution out of the Beit Din and given it to the civil courts, because you're asking them to apply civil law. But to give a lot of credit to the Beit Din, they very quickly got in line based on contract and said that there was always this understanding, this internal contract, implicit contract, so that we can divide a man's property and give some of it to the woman, although they tend to not give as much as a civil court would give. But they do give more child support and spousal support, and there's other things that a Beit Din will do that a civil court won't do. So that's why in Israel there is something called Meirut Samchuyot, a race to the courts, because depending on who you are, and it's not always man versus woman, it's more complicated than that. It really depends what's going on. It also depends on fault, because fault is still relevant. We'll get to that in a second. But there is a race to the courts. I'll talk. Okay. So two systems, power struggles between the two systems, a lot of tension between modernity versus tradition. There are civil marriages, we know. You can't conduct them in Israel, but you can go outside of Israel and come back. And then the question is, who does the divorce? The civil courts or the religious courts? Answer, religious courts. Why? Because everyone who gets divorced in Israel, if they're both of the same faith, they have to go to the religious courts. If you're a separate, if you're different faiths and you marry outside of Israel and come back, or if you're homosexual, then there is a process for divorce, but that's in the civil courts. So it's a lot of power grabs.
You can go abroad to get divorced if you want to have a civil divorce.
And then it will be recognized here.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Really? But this was a series of hard-fought cases to get to where we are now, which is that basically, on the one hand, this is a place where homosexuals can't marry. On the other hand, they can marry in Massachusetts, get divorced here, have children here, and everything is on the books. But that's a whole different lesson in the system of the registration here. So race to the courts. One question I get a lot is, how much is the race to the courts alive? So on the one hand, some say, why should there be a need to race to the courts? Because I've just told you that the same laws are supposed to apply in the two systems. However, real differences persist, as I already said. Child support, property distribution, because there's a different hashkafat olam between the rabbis and between the civil justices, much more precedential system. There's still a race to the courts, and you need to be a knowledgeable lawyer to know which place would be better for your client. So it is very strategic. It's often gender-related, often because of the property distribution stuff. It is better for a woman to go to a civil court, but not always. If you're the Eshet Chayil and you don't have a lot of money and nobody has a lot of money in your family and you didn't do anything wrong, you can get better spousal support, better housing, and better child support with the Beit Din. So the Beit Din always says, you know, it's not so bad for a woman by us. And that's true. It depends who you are. It's not so simple to say always it's better for the woman to go to civil courts. Okay, contracts in Jewish. So you can ask me questions about that. We don't have a lot of time. But okay, contracts in Jewish law. Jewish law is very big on contracts, as you've learned, much bigger than other systems like in the United States. You're not allowed to have a contract between a married couple because a married couple is one body. You can't have a contract. But in Jewish law, contracts are big. Everything is big. So a lot of things get done through contracts. You can have a contract in Israel during marriage. You can have a contract before marriage. You can have a contract about custody. You can have a contract about property distribution. And contracts are generally enforceable. The courts prefer to enforce a contract than they do to make a decision. A ketubah is a form of premarital contract, essentially. Before you get married, you decide what she's going to get at the end. So the question was, Michelle raised, which is a very good one apparently, is what is the relevance of kedubot in modern Israeli family law? So apparently, women have a choice whether or not to enforce their kedubot. They do because it's a contract, and they can enforce it. However, what happens when you enforce your ketubah? You give up property distribution. Because you just had a premarital contract that says what your property distribution is. So
That's all you're getting.
So what happens?
Stuff that's joint?
No. Joint, okay. If it says both of your names on it, it's half-half.
Okay.
But if you want property that's only in your husband's name, and you want to enforce your ketubah, mm-hmm. then all you get is your ketubah. So the way that the law has developed in Israel is that a woman has the choice to enforce her premarital contract, but 99% of women
don't.
They waive their rights for their ketubah. They would prefer to have the property distribution, whatever it means. So that's how it's, I don't know, about 99%. I actually haven't practiced that much family law in Israel. But what I understand from talking to lawyers is that there's not a lot of ketubah litigation. If they want their ketubah, that's fine. And, of course, the Beit Din is happy to give it to them because that means that they get to apply, because of her consent, they get to apply religious law as opposed to civil law, which they'd love to do. But if a woman chooses to, she can have property distribution instead, but not both.
I have a question. You might not know the answer, which is fine. If a man dies, and then she's supposed to get rights to his ketubah, and she's supposed to get mizonah from the estate, let's say that all the estate, I assume nowadays usually the estate is divided, she inherits him, but, or if they have joint accounts, but let's say
he can make a will.
Accounts, what happens to his
will?
Yeah, he can make a will. Will is their covea here, so you can de-will
Let's say he doesn't give her mizona, but she has a ketubah that says she gets,
I do know the answer. Okay. I'm learning. So, in Israel, unlike in other countries, you can totally disinherit your spouse.
Okay.
However, if a spouse is particularly oni, there's real koshi, there's a need, but you have to be poor, they have a right to an amount of mizonot, support from the property, mm-hmm. but it's only through need.
Okay.
It's not because you want it. It's because of need.
It's written in the ketubah.
And it's not because it's written in the ketubah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you don't get any ketubah,
I don't know if it's written in the ketubah. I don't know if it's because of her, but I know that the law is that you, because of Oni, will always get, I don't know, I don't know the answer, because I don't know how it relates to the ketubah, but I know that they're statutorily, if a woman needs the money, the estate has to give it to her, even if she's written out of the will.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if you could try to enforce your ketubah on that amount, because the ketubah is supposed to be enforceable.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know the answer. You're right. Okay. Blame in Jewish law. Last topic.
Yeah. What about the Heskem, the Kavod Hadadi, which is becoming more and more popular? How is that affecting the status of a ketubah if you have a prenuptial? It's like the halachic prenuptial.
Right. To forbid a get.
Mm-hmm.
How is it affecting the ketubah? Why would it affect the ketubah?
It wouldn't, right?
Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out why that would affect
the
ketubah.
It's just forcing him.
It's just forcing him to give her a get.
It's a monetary
bonus on
him if he doesn't give a get.
Right, if he doesn't give a get.
But there's not one for the other way, which is interesting.
Right, because it's also a woman.
She doesn't agree to receive the get.
I wonder if
you can.
I think it's both sides.
She just said it's Hadadi.
I just read it. All just came for the D.
Can people sign both sides?
Yes.
People do.
Yes.
It's
not
so much. It's not as pretty rare.
Are you sure that? I think it's generally. Well, it's rare that people sign it at all.
Rare.
It's rare that they sign it.
Both sides?
Yes. It's very rare. It's very, very rare.
I thought that. Really? I don't remember anymore what we said.
But they didn't have
the Hiskem Kavod.
They
did when I got married.
Yeah.
David said he signed something that he would.
Right.
You can still do it now because in Israel you can enforce a contract during marriage that it's never too late. In America you can't do it because it's premarital contracts and you're not allowed to do marital contracts. It's never too late in Israel. You can pick up a contract and do it today. It's no problem. It's a big difference between the legal systems. Okay.
What are you saying about disinheriting ketubah or disinheriting?
No, a spouse. You could say I'm not going to give inheritance to my wife.
You can, in Israel.
In a will.
She only if she needs it, she can get her, let's say, mizonot ketubah, but just minimum.
Ketubah.
She can demand her ketubah.
So that's when civil and religion clash.
Well,
no, it's because I think according to what Pamela's saying is that you have a contract.
Right.
So it's not necessarily
it's not a
religious,
clash,
it's
correct.
Just that you have a contract that commits.
Oh, so if
he
writes out of the will,
that's
the contract.
So you'll have two different contracts. So you'll
right.
have to bring them both.
You have a civil contract and a religious contract
right.
that are clashing.
Right, so she'll get whatever is committed in the first, you know, in the
tuba,
and then she won't get anything passed
out. I don't know.
From the will.
I don't teach inheritance
sounds
law,
like.
And this has it has come up the issue of every woman is entitled, even if she's been disinherited. But I don't know the clash of the.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say for sure. Sorry.
Okay,
right.
Yeah.
Guilt.
Guilt. Okay. So
sorry.
Around the world, there's been a international revolution, the no-fault revolution, right? So in the United States, if you want to get divorced, you don't have to prove grounds. You can prove grounds, but most people get divorced in a no-fault system, and this is not just the United States, all over the world. Under Jewish law, we have very much a fault system here, and there are three possible consequences of fault, grounds for divorce, denying spousal support, and can be a factor in property distribution. So I was just going to
follow that.
Okay. Three things. So I said that in Jewish law, it's a fault-based system. We'll talk about that in a second
mm-hmm.
because, of course, even with a ground, the rabbis can't force the divorce. That has to be out of free will. But it is a grounds-based system. So but what does that mean? How does the grounds affect the divorce? So it's a ground for having the divorce, which will mean that the stronger the ground, the more the rabbis will push. And I'll talk about that in a second. It can also be a grounds for denying spousal support, mizonot isha.
He doesn't have to give her.
Correct. And it can be a factor in property distribution. Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right, that's
to
say below tuba
yeah.
and all those
right.
things, right?
Makes a lot of sense. Right.
Okay. So what is blame and how does it work in the context of divorce law? First, and this is very liberal. Jewish law is very liberal in this way because it's been this way forever and like only more modernly have other systems come to this. If both sides agree to a divorce, you don't need a ground. So there is free consensual divorce, which is like obviously Catholicism, Christianity didn't have anything like that. So that's always been the case. But the need for divorce has to be a free will, as you know, on both sides. And so then the question is what role for grounds? Because even if I prove that my wife has adultered, in theory, she still has to freely accept the divorce. So that's when Jewish law becomes complicated. So on the one hand, its grounds are not symmetric. The same thing that could be a ground for divorce for a man cannot be a ground for a divorce for a woman. For instance, a man cheats once, not a ground for a divorce. A woman cheats once, it's a ground for forcing a divorce. So there's three stages of fault and divorce. A mitzvah litzgaresh, chiyuv litzgaresh, obligation, and kfiya litzgaresh. The rabbis almost never get to the third stage. When you get to the third stage, you can imprison him. That's a real get denier. It happens, but it's rare. Most of the time, it's just mitzvah litzgaresh. Sometimes it's mechayev litzgaresh, and that's when they will increase mizonot on the man. The rabbis will do this in order to force him to give a get. So what kinds of things can create these grounds that will create this graduated scale? So first they come in. They have to have the grounds in the claim. And then depending on the grounds, they'll say mitzvah, chiyuv, or kfiya, litzgaresh. And then it's a process of getting the get given. And it still has to be done in free will.
So if they say mitzvah, litzgaresh, what happens? Nothing?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Absolutely
it's useless,
nothing.
Basically.
It's up to him for his free will. And the grounds are asymmetric, and the chiyuv is asymmetric.
It's just enough for the guy to think twice. But that's
it affects, right. It affects the property distribution. It protects the economics of it, because he knows that the rabbis are not on his side, let's
mm-hmm.
say, and the fault is against him. Or it depends who the fault is. There could be a mitzvah litzgaresh on the woman, because
uh-huh.
she was the one who was at fault. So the kinds of faults, there's an endless list of fault. It's all very moral, but infertility, abandonment, adultery, immoral behavior, violence, no chance for shalom bayit. And there's two that go straight to kfiya. Reach ra, which the rabbis never want to do because it's kfiyat get. Reach ra, he smells bad. I don't know, like something so disgusting about him that I can't possibly live with him.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go there very often. And serious illness, like it was like tzaraat, like if they have leprosy or something. And that would go directly to kfiya, but the rabbis don't like to do that. But there are all these intra-halachic ways that if the rabbis wanted to get harsher on the man, they could go up to kfiyah. Once you get up to kfiyah, you can imprison the guy.
Adultery is not enough for kfiyah?
Adultery is not enough for kfiyah.
Why? What?
It's enough for kfiyah. It's enough for chiyuv. Serious adultery might be enough. Remember, one adulterous affair, if she can only prove one, it's not even enough for mitzvah. But once it starts becoming a process, if she can prove multiples, yes, then it can become chiyuv, which means she can get more mezonot, which is a financial pressure, but won't get it to kfiyah. That's over time. When does it get to kfiyah? It's like very rare, and it's like it's been 2 years, it's been 3 years, it's been 4 years.
And then they go to kfiyah.
But rarely. But they do get there, but it's relatively rare.
I think the adultery is because a man was allowed to have more than one wife.
Right, is that why?
And there's no issue of mamzerut.
There's no issue
of
mamzerut.
I think, yeah, but it's still after Takanah Rabbeinu Gershom, it's against the law.
That's
right.
But
it's not.
But it's not the same.
It's always been forgiving, you know, they turn a blind eye, or they're forgiving if a man has to go to another city.
Mm-hmm.
In the Rabbeinu, they said go to a city and do what he had to do.
Just think of this, even the way the Torah treats it, so tough versus...
Right, versus the man.
So as soon as he can prove that she's adulterous, it goes straight to kfiyah.
And then what do? They put her in jail? Does that ever happen? Well, it did happen with that case. Wasn't there that case recently? The woman was put in jail.
It can happen.
She's
not going
to... She was a ceramic kit, but
it's true. Look, it's true that there is symmetry in a sense, and that she has to do it except at every one, and he has to. But because she knows in the back of her head that in severe cases, the rabbis will lakof, they will go around her. Bashetach, in the field,
she generally
women don't... It happens, but these are like really rare cases, and women tend to fold because the rabbis will push her and say, "We're not going to let you get away with this."
The woman's always taking care of the children, so of course they're going to fold.
Well, also because they know that the rabbis can go around them in a way that the man knows
right,
that the rabbis
get
can't.
Right, you get in which case
right.
It's...
There's an organization in Florida that will receive a get on behalf of the woman. Mm-hmm. There's ways to get around it.
They'll get around her.
Get around.
And the rabbis
let
her know that, and that creates a different dynamic when
exactly.
They're bargaining. So even though there's free symmetry, there's not so much symmetry. Okay, last thing I was going to talk about is the grounds. How does grounds affect the divorce? So we talked a little bit about it affects the financial matters, because if a man thinks that they're going to go to kfiyah, it could really affect him. Like, he's more willing to give his divorce if I want to go to jail. But even if the spousal support gets raised, and even in theory, if he thinks that he has a mitzvah to divorce her, it might, but less, because it's less pressure. It's not supposed to affect custody at all, and that's why they made it civil law. That's what the state was very... custody is always supposed to be about best interests of the child. They didn't want any of these grounds to influence custody. So that was part of the process of moving custody out of religious law, because it could have affected it, because everything's affected by grounds when it comes to religious law. Increased spousal support, I said. Influence property distribution. That's really an interesting one. So the civil system has gone to a basically no-fault system when it comes to property distribution. We'll just do it 50-50. But the rabbis like to, if somebody's at fault, they like to... And there's some room in the law, like other things, where, you know, it's like a list of, here are the things you can think about when you do property distribution. And the civil courts read that to mean it's not about fault. And the rabbinical courts, if they get the property distribution because it was karuch to the tviat gerushin, they might... sock it to her. So it's never good for a cheating wife to go to rabbinical courts.
Mm-hmm.
It's dangerous. They should always go to
civil
courts.
It reminds me of the sugyas we were learning about the influences the dayanim had on them when they were making their decisions. Mm-hmm. Even though in theory they might intellectually separate and say, well, this guy wants to give me a gift, I didn't accept it, but yet somehow underneath everything you do is affected by what you're thinking, And when an adulterous woman comes before a Beit Din, there's no way they're thinking positively about her. So
correct.
Their
and
judgment.
That's that hashkafat olam. And it's not only affecting their judgment in theory, which it is, it's also affecting it by Jewish law, which even if they're not supposed to apply, it's very hard for them. And that's like a big theme that I've learned from teaching Jewish family law. It's like, we criticize the rabbis all the time. Everything is more complex than it seems. And the civil country has put a huge burden on the rabbis in making them, on the one hand, say, yes, it's religious law, but you have to apply civil law when it comes to child custody, which they always get to decide, and property distribution, and... not child support. And anyway, when it comes... Oh, spousal support. No, religious law. So there's two ways. When it comes to spousal support, she can always choose. Why? Because it's her choice. She can choose whether to go to religious court or civil court. No matter which court she goes to, they're supposed to apply religious law. The other way she could choose is to get there first, meaning she has to, if she wants the civil court, she needs to put the claim for property distribution, child support, custody into the civil system.
Before he gets
it into the religious system. That's the race to the courts. Me roots, some cuyo. That's the biggest issue. I mean, teaching family law in Israel compared to teaching family law in America, like, we don't have a race to the courts there. And here, half the course is about a race to the courts. So, very different.
What do American Jews do? They
will get divorced here. I mean, God forbid.
No,
but.
No, Jews in America, I mean. They have their religious system, and then they have...
That's an excellent question.
...as opposed to parallel
Correct.
To them.
You can't get divorced in a Beit Din and have that be in America and have that have the force of law. You must go to a civil system and to a religious system. Here you have to only go to one. Oh, there only is one system for divorce. That's the religious system. But parts of it can be broken off and put into the civil system, and usually are. Unless she puts everything into the Beit Din, or they agree to have everything in the Beit Din. So there's always two issues. What law applies, and where, who's deciding? The rabbis or the civil judges?
Thank you very much.
Okay. That was really